Well, no, I'm talking about the members on the panel that know and understand the issues, present the evidence or do the investigation, but it's got to be body of judge or an AG.
Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order, please. First topic today is a confirmation of Gerald Kaplan of the Board of Judicial Standards. Mr. Kaplan, please come forward. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators.
Members, we will take action on the confirmation proposal today. From here, it will go to the Senate floor, and then the full Senate will take up the confirmation calendar at the discretion of the leadership. What we have before us is the confirmation proposed to Mr. Kaplan of the Board of Judicial Standards. Members, in your packet, you have some background information, the governor's nomination information, and some correspondence and a resume from Mr. Kaplan as well. We won't be able to take formal action until we have a quorum present, but we'll go ahead and we'll begin the hearing, and if we don't have at least one more member present before we're ready to vote, then we will set it aside for a moment until one more person shows up. Mr. Kaplan, why don't you tell us why you'd like to serve on the Board of Judicial Standards?
Well, I think my interest is no different than anyone who would even be interested in public service or running for public office. And that's to make the state of Minnesota a better place to live. And I think it's critical in a civilized society to have the criminal justice system which is fair and above reproach. And judges really are at the top of that system. They have a great deal of power and a great deal of ability to affect people's lives. To that end, I think judges have to be held to the highest standards of professionalism and ethical conduct. I've stated before, I indicated that my background provides a dimension that's not typically found in a public member on the Board on Judicial Standards. Probably the most personal reason that I have is that, it's an opportunity to really learn about another profession. I've been on the Board of Medical Practice for 7 years, done complaint review on the Board of Medical Practice during all that time. I'm a former chair of the Board of Psychology. I did complaint review and chaired a complaint review committee for 6 years. I learned a lot about medicine. I'm learning about the judicial system, even though my practice in psychology is a forensic practice, and I appear in court often or have in the past and have been an expert witness. In many ways, I've learned more, or it's been more interesting, on the Board of Judicial Standards and on the medical board than the Board of Psychology. On the Board of Psychology, I learned how to improve my practice, but I wasn't learning about an entirely different occupation.
Members, you will see that Mr. Kaplan has a more detailed description of his background in the packets. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to take a look at it. If you have any questions or comments, any questions for Mr. Kaplan? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. How many public members are there on the Board of Judicial Standards?
Mr. Kaplan.
I'll have to think about that for a minute, Mr. Chair, Senator.
Approximately.
I believe there are five.
Okay. One of the nice things I think
Senator
about
Sharon.
The legal profession, both the Judicial Standards Board and the Lawyers Board of Professional Responsibility, is the involvement of public members. I think it really elevates the product and the trust of the community in the decisions that are made by those boards. So I really appreciate that you're willing to come forward, and I think your background is very impressive, particularly in these times, in these days when we have a number of issues around the areas that you have expertise. But I just have one question about your background. I'm just very supportive of this candidate. But I see that you have in your history, and I wondered what in this work history from this experience uniquely brings something for you in this new role, and that is that you drove a taxi in and around the Los Angeles area.
Well,
Mr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that probably did more for my education as a psychologist than graduate school. Especially in Los Angeles, it was a very interesting experience.
Thank you.
I have a few stories, but I won't take the time here.
Right, Senator
Thank you.
Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kaplan, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to come forward and offer to serve on this board. You are a very, very, very important job, position for judges.
Senator Newman, could you pull the mic toward you? People, I can't even hear you.
I think the public has the right to expect the highest standard of conduct out of our judges. And I want to echo the comments of Senator Sharon that I think it's really, really important that we have folks coming out of the community who are not involved in the legal community as lawyers and judges to serve on the board. So I just wanted to thank you for coming forward.
Thank you, Senator.
For the record, Senator Sharon, there are four judicial members, judges, two attorneys, and four public members on the Board on Judicial Standards. Senator Lemon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I have known Mr. Kaplan, I think it's getting close to 30 years now, and we've served on a variety of boards and commissions over those years. I think the earliest one was before I was a legislator. We served on a advisory board to the Hennepin County Corrections System way back in, I think, mid-'80s. And most recently, he and I shared membership in the Minnesota Sexual Offender Task Force this last year. And over the years that I have known Mr. Kaplan, I have found his judgment to be fair-minded, to be thoughtful, and one that is not afraid to ask critical questions when it's necessary. And I think with that knowledge of temperament and character, I think Mr. Kaplan would be an excellent choice as a public member on the Judicial Standard Board. And I certainly have no hesitation to vouch for his quality.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what Senator Limmer said. I have not known him at all, but the taxi driver part is good enough for me.
All right. Is there any further discussion or questions relating to the nomination of Mr. Kaplan? Hearing none, Senator Limmer, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I would move the the confirmation of Gerald Kaplan as a member of the public, or a public member on the Board on Judicial Standards. Be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
All right, Senator Limmer so moves. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank
you,
Mr.
Kaplan.
Mr. Chair, Senators.
Members, please make sure that your cell phones are far enough away from the mics that they're not interfering. And if you have a cell phone out in the room, will you please make sure it's turned inaudible? Thank you very much. All right, next bill up is Senator Rust's bill, 1287. Welcome, Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1287 is a proposal to change the law to allow transfer on death of title to for a motor vehicle. Currently, there are about 10 or 12 states that allow the title to be to include a transfer on death beneficiary, so that when someone dies, the title and the automobile automatically go to that named beneficiary without the automobile having to go in or the vehicle having to go into probate. The bill came to me from a constituent whose husband died and their car was in his name. And she had to go through a lot of busy work, et cetera, to get the car transferred to her. And this would allow it to automatically happen. It wouldn't necessarily have to be a spouse, but that you could name a beneficiary. You could change the bill allows for you to change the beneficiary as you will. But it simplifies the process enormously. It also adds the TOD to the list of transactions that, with regard to transferring automobiles, that do not cause a taxable event. But because we added that provision, it does need to, if you act on it favorably, it needs to go to the tax committee.
All right, members, the Section 1 is the section that falls within the judiciary's jurisdiction, so that additional tax provision is of no particular concern to us.
Okay. We'll let taxes just explaining
that
it,
out.
That's all.
No,
where
I,
it needs
I appreciate
to go
that,
next.
Senator
Rust.
Yeah. I know you're very good in your committee at focusing your committee on the jurisdiction provision. So, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is an area that I am somewhat familiar with, and I would encourage you to support Senator Rest's bill. There are ways to transfer the title to a motor vehicle after death when the motor vehicle is owned in the name of one person, but this is going to be an added way for folks to transfer title to a motor vehicle without the need of, say, hiring an attorney or going through probate or going through the other rigmarole that Senator Rest was referring to, which is, it's not unduly burdensome, but I really do think that this is a good idea and it will be helpful for our constituents.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much, Senator Newman. Why this is streamlined is that it's easy, it's free to set up. You don't need an attorney. You can change your mind at any time. It just simplifies the whole process.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, if you already have the title for a car and you want to put a beneficiary on it based on your bill, how do you go about that with your bill?
Senator Rest.
Just add that person's name to the title. In the same way, if you were going to sell the automobile, you have to change the title. And it, if you look at beyond the first subdivision there, it allows you to do that. I'm not sure of the precise. Senator Newman knows how you change a title when it maybe is just a gift or so on. There's no taxable event anyway, but I assume you have to do it with the Department of Public Safety.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Yeah, I think that what would transpire in answer to Senator Goodwin's question is in order to create the transfer on death, you take the certificate of title to the local motor vehicle department and fill out the appropriate forms, and the transfer in death would be put on the actual certificate of title. Then upon the death, the beneficiary would take the certificate of title along with a death certificate back to the Department of Motor Vehicle. They would process it, and the state would spit out a new certificate in just the name of the beneficiary. Very easy, very clean, very inexpensive method for our constituents to transfer title to a motor vehicle. It really is quite a good idea.
Thank you.
Senator Newman is spitting out a certificate, a term of art.
It is indeed, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, as I look over the bill, does this focus just on private owners, or could a corporate owner, let's say an LLC or a Chapter S corporation, could they benefit from this same ownership title treatment?
Well, certainly, I would ask counsel about that, but it is the more common situation would be a vehicle owned by a spouse or by a parent or so forth. It doesn't release the vehicle from having to continue paying for it, for example. I mean, that's not dissolved. So if there was an attempt to do that by naming a beneficiary, but I don't know whether a corporation can, even though it might be a person, whether it can die.
Right, right.
I think it's about the death of a natural person.
It's possible, Senator Rest, under the language here, I suppose a person could designate a corporation as a beneficiary. Could they not?
I don't know.
That kind of raises.
I would ask counsel to see whether that is possible. I don't know whether there's any particular objection to it, but.
Mr. Chair, perhaps we could examine this a little bit better at a later time. I don't think it needs to interfere with the passage of this bill.
We'll try to get answers to those questions some other time, but there seems to be a sense of the committee we should move the bill on right now. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
Then Senator Newman, would you like to move the bill?
And this would go to the Tax Committee, Mr. Chairman?
Taxes. Exactly where Senator Rest likes to be.
I'll bet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate File 1287 be recommended to pass and proceed to the Tax Committee.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Dahl, Senate File 1246.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
Welcome
members.
To the committee, Senator.
You have Senate File 1246, the A2 amendment, and this was just an amendment that there was just a little concern from the Department of Public Safety and just some wording regarding collision or injury, and we fixed that with the Department of Public Safety, and I don't believe they'll need to testify, although they're certainly welcome to, but we have addressed their concerns, and that's what the A2 does since we heard this in transportation.
All right, members, you have in your packet the A2 amendment. Senator Dahl, could you give us a little more description of what the change is here and what its impact would be?
I'm going to allow my testifier.
Or, actually, counsel has indicated to me they can make that description.
Okay,
so, Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, the A2 amendment basically goes back to the term accident in subdivisions 5 to 14A and 16 and 17 of 169.06. Those are really the accident reporting provisions, and it retains the new term collision in the hit and run provisions of that section. It also changes some head notes, rewords one of the criminal provisions to read a little more directly, and then it adds that subdivision 19 on line 1.27.
So, Mr. Backus, it's more in the nature of a technical clarifications than any substantive changes?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's correct. Again, I think it goes back to the bill that probably was intended to begin with. The advocates didn't want to make any of the changes necessarily with the accident reports, and I think Department of Public Safety are probably more comfortable with that anyway.
Mr. Backus, at least on the first several changes, appear to be made to the titles of the subdivisions, not to the language in the paragraphs below. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, it does amend some of the head notes, but it also amends the substantive language of the provisions. I think the amendment looks a lot more complicated than it really is, because basically what it's doing is it's mostly just replacing the where they changed accident to collision back to accident again for most of the section.
Okay, and explain to me again, why is it being changed back to accident?
Mr. Chair, I think I'd defer to the advocate on that one.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Kelly Moeller, and I am here representing the Minnesota Alliance on Crime. The Bill 169, the statute, actually does two things. One, it covers the hit and run, and the second part of the statute covers the reporting requirements for the Department of Public Safety for all accidents, not just hit and run accidents. And so when we, for the hit and run purposes, wanted to leave the term in collision in the statute, but it was creating problems for the Department of Public Safety because that part of the bill that deals with public safety has accident reporting, and so they were worried that by changing the term collision for all of the reporting requirements, it was going to cause problems.
So even though collision might be the more accurate term, since accident seems to imply an absence of negligence or some other standard of conduct, just for ease of reference and the fact that accident is used so frequently throughout the statutes, that's why you want to go back to that previous language?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I think at some point Department of Public Safety is going to maybe propose changing accident to crash because they do their crash reports every year now. But at this point, they aren't doing that, and so it was just easier to keep it as accident now. And if someday they want to do a global change, they could do that.
Okay. Does anyone else have any questions relating to the A2 amendment? All right. Senator Dedzic, will you move the A2 amendment?
Yep.
Senator Dedzic moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1246, as amended, clarifies the hit-and-run statute by requiring drivers involved in collisions to, another word there, to determine what they struck. It closes the loophole in the current law that encourages drivers to flee the scene of a collision and then, if caught, escape liability by claiming they did not know what they had struck. In 2007, the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed a hit-and-run conviction based on the language in the current statute and stated that the legislature could rewrite the law to require drivers to stop and determine what was struck. This law has continued to be a problem since 2007, and stopping and offering assistance to someone injured in a collision could make the difference between life and death. And oftentimes, I noticed in the first hearing with the transportation, we think about the driver, and we're all worried about the driver, and you know, what's his defense going to be, et cetera, or hers. And I think, let's get back to that, this could really help a victim who has been hit by someone and then that person drove off, when maybe stopping and checking to see what they had actually hit could maybe have saved a life. So I do have Chris Zell. Her brother, Kane Thompson, was tragically a victim in a 2007 Supreme Court case, that the El Nasir case that I just cited. Allow her testimony.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Chris Zell, and I'm from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. I live with my husband, two boys, and I work as an accountant. First of all, I'd like to tell you how grateful I am to be here to speak with you today and to thank you for your thoughtful consideration on this proposed hit-and-run legislation. I'm here on behalf of my family, my dad, my brother, and my brother's widow. I'm here to testify in support of this proposed legislation. My brother, Kane Thompson, was 26, and he was killed by a hit-and-run driver while legally changing a tire on the side of the road on June 16, 2002. As you can imagine, it was a day that changed our lives forever. The driver who struck and killed Kane was charged and convicted with two felony counts, including hit-and-run. To be perfectly honest, the charges, the conviction, none of that really mattered to our family. We felt we needed to spend our energy on healing from this horrible ordeal. However, after 7 years of appeals to the Minnesota State Supreme Court and the ultimate reversal of the hit-and-run conviction, we could no longer sit back and watch. The Supreme Court said that the state failed to prove that he knew he hit a person or a vehicle. We find this hard to believe. After all, he hit a 230-pound man. He ran over and drug a 5-inch thick tire from Kane's car with a flat tire of his own, a dent in his hood, a broken-out headlight at 11:30 at night. The pure and very simple fact is he did not stop to investigate what he had hit. The Supreme Court reversal has ultimately paved the way for people to claim ignorance as to what was hit. We've seen it used already in a couple of hit-and-run cases, most notably the Amy Sensor case. It's very difficult to prove what's going on in a mind of someone at the time of a collision. It encourages drunk or other impaired drivers to leave the scene instead of offering life-saving assistance. This proposed legislation requires those drivers to stop and investigate what they've struck. This change could help many people and quite possibly save lives. Every time I hear of another hit-and-run story on the news, I am first sick to my stomach about how that family that has just been torn apart is feeling. And secondly, appalled to think that I will probably again soon be hearing of how the hit-and-run reversal is going to be used to benefit someone else. It's incomprehensible to me that we allow this to continue. The time has come for the statute to be fixed. I thank you for your thoughtful attention. Please pass it, and let's move forward holding people accountable for their actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zell. Sorry for your loss. Any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Zell? Senator Limmer?
Oh, not for her.
Would you like,
thank you,
Mr. Chair, Kelly Mueller from again to give her testify.
Thank you, Ms. Mueller. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. As I said, I'm here representing the Alliance on Crime, but I'm also an appellate prosecutor, and I handled the case, one of the many appeals to the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Al Nazir case that involved Chris's brother Kane. And as both she and Senator Dahl said, the Supreme Court reversed that conviction, saying that the state failed to prove that Al Nazir knew he hit a person or a car, and therefore he was not guilty of hit and run. And the Supreme Court specifically said in that opinion in 2007 that there may be a shortcoming in the statute and that the legislature might want drivers to stop and investigate what it is they've struck and then remain at the scene if it ends up being a person or another car. And that's exactly what this bill today does. It fixes that shortcoming. It closes that loophole in the statute that allows drivers to escape, and it also can provide life-saving support for somebody that is injured in a collision. Just to be clear here, a person who doesn't stop and investigate is only going to be criminally liable if, in fact, they've hit a person or a car.
Mr. Chair, can I interrupt?
Senator Dole.
I'm wanted in another committee for a vote, and then may I return quick?
Sure.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Would you like us to lay the bill on the table until you return? Because there may be some discussion or questions here while you're gone.
Why don't you continue, and I'll be back shortly.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Miller.
Thank you, and I'm almost done here. I just wanted to say, too, that the requirements in the statute regarding someone to provide notice and information, none of those things are changing, nor are any of the penalties changing here. We do have letters of support from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, County Attorneys Association, MAD, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, and the Bicycle Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mueller. Any questions from Ms. Mueller by members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look over this bill, there's quite a reliance on the word collision as a new language. And I know that we had used the word in discussion, crash, collision. I don't know if there's really semantically a whole lot of difference. Since we rely on the word collision so much, is there a would there be a need for a definition in statute of what collision means? Or are we not going to do that and then just leave it up to the discretion of a judge to make that decision on a case-by-case basis? Do you have an opinion on that?
Ms. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we did have a discussion about this with the County Attorneys Association as well, and the idea is to leave the term collision undefined, because when we started to try to define it, it got a little cumbersome and wordy, and what will happen is the judge won't be the one to define it. The judge will instruct the jury that they're to use their own common sense understanding or knowledge of terms, so the judge won't be crafting an instruction to cover the term collision.
Mr. Chair.
If I can
just kind of play devil's advocate on this, going back, when I think of the word collision, that's one object running into or striking another. I could foresee in a freeway near me, where in my district, it's highly congested at a high rate of speed. Oftentimes, due to weather conditions, it's not well lit. It has a traffic pattern of 120,000 cars a day. And even law enforcement will not enforce the traffic laws in that stretch of freeway. They will, if they deem it necessary, they'll follow an individual car far away from that area. I could see where if someone hit something and was required to pull over, it might be risking their lives as well to pull over at that moment. Would this bill create any difficulty for that individual?
Ms. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Senator, no, it wouldn't create a difficulty because the bill follows the current language of the statute, which is they must stop at the scene or as close to the scene as possible. So if it would put their life in risk or in danger, then they could easily go to the next stop, you know, pull over, get off the highway, or whatever the situation may be, and then call. Subdivision 6 also requires that there be notice to law enforcement, and that person would be then in compliance with the statute.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
one other
and then
question.
We're gonna, what I'm going to ask you to do is make a note of your question. I've been informed by Senator Dahl's staff that he's going to be detained longer than expected. And I think as a courtesy to the chief author, we ought to make these inquiries while he is present.
All right.
So at this point, I'm going to exercise the discretion of the chair and lay the bill over. And we'll take it up as soon as we complete the bill that we're on whenever Senator Dahl gets back. So thank you. And so Senate File 1247 is laid over at the moment. Senator Hoffman. You present, Senate File 1792?
No. Something's not here.
Senator Hoffman is not present. We'll move on to Senate File 1904. Senator Jensen, are you present?
She's also in.
Senator Champion?
I'm present, Mr. T.
All right. I would hope so. Senate File 2244, in the form of pauperous party proceedings. And Ms. Hugdahl is very fortunately surprised.
Mr. Chair, if I might, it reminds me of, you know, in school from time to time, they, you know, say your name and make sure that you're present. And I just like to make sure that I'm in the presence of greatness, so that's why I'm here at this committee. So
sounds like law school, Senator.
That's right.
No backbenching allowed here. All right, Senator Champion, Senate File 2244.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present this bill. This is a bill that was once carried by Senator Limmer, and what it seeks to do this year is just to bring some additional clarity, and this language has also been looked at by Senator Limmer as well. So in 2011, the legislature amended the informal pauperous statute to do two things. One, create the ability for judges to order a reduced civil filing fee and permit reimbursement of a filing fee in whole or in part if a party's financial circumstances change. And the 2011 language, which was the result of a compromise discussion, was as follows. If, at or following commencement of the action, the party is or becomes able to pay all or a portion of the fees, costs, and security for costs, the court may order payment of a fee of $75 or reimbursement or partial payment of all or a portion of the fees, costs, and security for costs to be paid as directed by the court. That is what the language was. The language combines both concepts, reduced fees, and reimbursement into one sentence. While many courts have interpreted this language consistent with its original intent, there's been enough consistency or of inconsistency to warrant clarification. So while there are some differing filing fees, generally the civil filing fee in district court is $324. Conciliation court, as you know, is lower. For example, in Hennepin County, it is $70, which is similar to many other districts. A dissolution is higher. For example, in Hennepin County, it is $404, which is similar to many other districts. This bill before you clarifies the statute in three ways. Number one, it clarifies that at the beginning of an action, the court can order a reduced filing fee for persons who are not eligible for a fee waiver but cannot afford the full filing fee. If you look at lines 1.22 to 2.1. It also clarifies, the second thing this bill does, it clarifies that if a person is either A, no longer categorically eligible for a filing fee waiver, or received a reduced filing fee but can now contribute more, the court can order reimbursement for any or all of the fees or costs, and moves the reimbursement provisions next to the provision in existing law for rescinding informal pauperis, and you can look at lines 2.7 to 2.12. And finally, it defines the term public assistance, which has been a basis for informal pauperis status since 1989, but never defined. And so if you look at line 1.17, there's a cross-reference to the term public assistance in the garnishment statute, which is exempt from garnishment. And outside that statute is Minnesota statute section 550.37, subdivision 14. It is important that these are all programs based on need, so it's a means-tested program. And so in summary, this bill is not intended to change the intent of the 2011 amendment, but rather clarify what was intended, better define public assistance, and reorganize the language in a more chronological order. That's simply what it does, and we would love to get your support, and I do have one testifier to just verify that this was the intent of the statute and was a part of their collective work.
Thank you. Ms. Hugdahl, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl with Legal Aid. Senator Champion really laid out the bill, and the intent was really just to clarify what we all understood in 2011 when these changes were made. As all of you know, the Informa Pauperis statute is really what guarantees equal access to the courts for citizens in Minnesota, and this committee's long had a very strong commitment to making sure that statute works well, and this is just a step in cleaning up the language to make sure that that access is there. So we appreciate your support of the bill as it moves forward in the process. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you. Senator Champion, council has a recommended minor amendment to line 1.17.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I would just delete under on page 1, line 17, and insert described in, because you don't actually receive public assistance under that section. It's a description of what's exempt. So,
Your Honor, see, I'm so used to being in court. Now I'm calling you, Your Honor. Senator Goodwin, Your Honor, the other day.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, so we will accept that as a friendly amendment.
All right, well, Senator Champion, you're a member of the committee, so you move to amend line 1.17 by deleting the new language under and inserting in its place described in. Any questions about the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Any other questions for the author or Ms. Hugdahl relating to this bill? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Champion, has court administration weighed in on the need for this bill at all?
I'm going to turn it over to the testifier, Mr. Chair, if that's possible.
Ms. Hugdahl.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman. We did send a copy of the bill toward the end of 2013 to the judicial branch to have them be able to look at it and ask for any feedback. They didn't have it for us. So they've seen the language of the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, when you say the judicial branch, you are referring to both, say, the District Court Judges Association and Court Administration?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. Senator Newman. I sent the bill to Janet Marshall with the judicial branch to have them take a look at it. I believe I did talk also with Nancy Haas, who represents both. She is the county attorneys and district judges. No one has contacted us with any concerns about the bill. We've reviewed it with a number of the legal organizations who represent civil cases, the county attorneys as well, and haven't had any questions. Certainly, if there are, we're happy to work with folks. But to date, no one has contacted us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any further questions or discussion? Senator Champion, move your bill.
I move passage of Senate File 224 and recommend it to pass and proceed to, I believe, the floor, Mr. Chair.
As amended. Yep, goes to the floor according to our notes here as well. So Senator Champion moves that Senate File 2244 be as amended, be recommended pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Champion. All right, I will ask if Senator Dahl is back. Not see Senator Dahl back. All right. I saw Senator Jensen walk in. Is she ready to go?
I am.
Senator Jensen. Senate File 1904.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1904 is the result of a lot of hard work that's been done by the Board of Optometry. They were tasked with implementing certification process for their licensees. And I believe that the issues that you wanted to take a look at have to do with the changes in the optometry licensure.
Okay, why don't we have Ms. Pontius identify for us what particular provisions are within our jurisdiction.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, should have a summary of the judiciary issues in your packet. And it starts with Section 8, which is the grounds for disciplinary action.
He says this is it for the year, though.
All right, members, on page 6 of your copy of the first engrossment, Section 8. So perhaps Senator Jensen, you or your witness could describe Section 8 to us.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. This is Dr. Don Cipolla. I'll have him talk to Section 8.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome, Doctor.
This is a 17-18-page bill, and the vast majority of the pages are related to grounds for disciplinary action and subsequent things that happen. And you'll see as it starts out on Section 8, there's a significant cross-out or elimination, and then the new language starts in 7.13. Everything you see after 7.13 all the way to the end of anything related to judiciary is basically carbon copy out of the Medical Practice Act. This has been vetted by other professionals and passed and put into statute for physicians. Our Attorney General representative felt that the two paragraphs or two sections here that talk about grounds for disciplinary action were inadequate and antiquated. I happened to look some of the items up, and some of them that were passed in 1925, so they've been around a long time. So this is more or less a housekeeping in the sense that we're bringing up the disciplinary portion to the standards that medicine currently use. That includes reporting requirements, immunity, cooperation, and specific disciplinary measures. If there are questions to a specific portion of that large number of pages, I'd be happy to try to respond.
Thank you. Doctor, for the record, would you please first describe for us precisely what optometry is as you're making comparisons to the medical profession?
Sure.
Let's make sure we identify our terms.
Sure. Optometrists are primary eye care providers. We examine eyes, diagnose eye disease, prescribe drugs and treatments. And we are at the primary care in the sense that we don't do surgery, which is secondary, or advanced complicated surgery, which is tertiary. In the state of Minnesota, approximately 66% of all eye care providers and eye care that's done are done by optometrists. We've been licensed in the state since, I believe, 1901.
And would you mind taking us through the particular acts which are being incorporated here as grounds for disciplinary action?
Very
Members,
good.
You also have in your packet the staff summary, which refers to some of this as well.
Thank you.
Doctor.
So we begin on line 7.13, and I think it's important to understand the very first sentence where it says the board may refuse to grant a license or may impose disciplinary action as described against any optometrist for the following 22 items in the list. The first one is failure to demonstrate qualifications, and it's the burden of proof is on the applicant. So that if a practitioner or someone applying for a license claims they have a graduate degree, they have certain qualifications, it's the burden of proof is on the person to produce those documents. The second one is obtaining a license by fraud or cheating, very common, and it describes numerous instances of how cheating can take place. Number three is conviction of a felony within the previous 5 years. Reasonably related to the practice of optometry. So if the felony has no bearing on the practice of optometry, it does not come under the purview of our Board of Optometry. If it has reasonable relation to the practice of optometry, then we are involved to determine what that level is and what should be done about it. Number four is if there is revocation or suspension in another state, we need to know about that. Number
so,
five.
Doctor, I want to back up for a second on the conviction section. Lines 7.32 to 3.4 indicate that conviction is also defined as a finding or verdict of guilt, but the adjudication of guilt is withheld or not entered. So there would be no conviction actually entered on the record, on the criminal record of the individual. Is that language that was adopted from elsewhere, or is that an addition to this particular bill?
This is exactly what's in the Medical Practice Act, and I think I looked this up in the Dental Practice Act and found a similar type of thing. So it seems to be a common, common language.
Okay, and could you help us understand if a conviction is not entered on a record as a conviction, why it's being deemed a conviction for purposes of disciplinary action here?
I think what this is attempting to say is that, and I think we heard a little bit earlier today about the Supreme Court overturning a situation, if this has to do with the practice of optometry or the qualifications of the individual to safely continue to practice optometry, then it still would come under review, but it does not require in any way, shape, or form disciplinary action or a refusal to grant a license. It just comes under review. So it's something that we should be perhaps aware of. I'm thinking that this and the other medical professions that use this use it in that way.
Okay, so the idea is that if you have one of these instances, the Board of Optometry gets notified, and the board can, in its discretion, choose to take action or investigate it further or choose not to?
Exactly.
But you want to make sure at least you've been notified of the conduct that led to even a stay of adjudication?
Correct.
My questions raise any further questions, my members? All right, please go on, Doc.
Number four, revocation and suspension in another state should be brought to our attention. Advertising, which is false and misleading. Violating a rule promulgated by the board or the state of Minnesota or a federal law. Engaging in unethical conduct, likely to deceive, defraud, which is currently in our statute. Failure to supervise an assistant and failure to supervise an optometrist under agreement with the board. That is not currently in statute. Aiding or abetting an unlicensed person to practice optometry. Education as mentally incompetent, mentally ill, developmentally disabled, sexually dangerous person. And in this case, such education shall automatically suspend a license for the duration thereof unless the board orders otherwise. So it still does allow the board to have some flexibility there. Number 11, engaging in unprofessional conduct, which includes any departure from the failure to conform to minimal standards of care. Number 12, inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety by reason of illness, alcohol, drugs, chemicals, or any other type of material. And I'm sensitive to that. I'm a city councilor up in the city of Virginia, and we've had the synthetic drug issue similar to Duluth has. And this would be any other form of material because it's not technically illegal, and it does cause a lot of trouble. Number 13, revealing a privileged communication. Number 14, improper management of medical record, including failure to maintain adequate records, fee splitting without limitation. And then I-2. Number 16, engaging in abusive or fraudulent billing practices, including Medicare and Medicaid, which is not currently in our statute. And it would come then before the Board of Optometry. Becoming addicted, habituated to a drug. Prescribing a drug or device other than for an accepted therapeutic or experimental basis. Engaging in conduct with a patient which is sexual or may be reasonably interpreted by the patient to be, or any verbal behavior. Number 20, failure to make reports required to cooperate with an investigation, which is not currently in statute, knowingly providing false or misleading information that is directly related to the care of that patient unless done for an accepted therapeutic purpose, such as administration of a placebo. And this is kind of included in the HIPAA language as well. And number 22, practice of a board-regulated profession under lapsed or non-renewed credentials.
So those are all discretionary.
Yes.
Review and discipline by the board. All right. And then if you would go on to subdivision 2, please.
Subdivision 2 is conviction of a felony-level criminal sexual conduct offense. The board may not grant a practice to optometry who has been convicted of a felony-level offense. A license to practice is automatically revoked if a licensee is convicted of a felony offense. The license that has been denied or revoked is not subject to Chapter 364.
What chapter is that, Doctor? So the Rehabilitation Act would not apply?
Not that familiar with it, but there is a modification to 364 that is in our bill here. There's an amendment in House Health and Human Services.
Section 13. So, well, why don't we...
Section 14.21, exceptions, 364.09.
Okay, so, Doctor, it sounds like, first of all, let me ask, is this language relating to subdivision 2 taken also directly out of the statutes relating to other doctors, medical?
Yes, it is, and I checked that again this morning.
And then... I mean, there are, maybe I should ask this question. What does felony level criminal sexual conduct offense include? I mean, what's the lowest level felony crim sex case?
I don't have
the statute in front of me, Council. Maybe
Mr. Chair, members, it includes first through fourth degree criminal sexual conduct and repeat violations of the fifth degree law. Fifth degree is generally a gross misdemeanor, though, first time. So basically first through fourth degree and then certain felony fifth degrees.
And what conduct is fourth degree cover?
Fourth degree is criminal sexual contact as opposed to penetration, the more lower level offenses compared to second degree. So there's some age-based differences, things along those lines. Relationships between certain types of specified actors that have been deemed illegal.
Like if one actor is more than 24 months older than the other actor and they're one is 17, under 18 years of age, that
yes.
kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, yes. You know, the third and fourth degree crim sexes are a lot of those things. There's the age-based differences and then the ones where it's the position of authority or the significant relationship ones. So the so-called Romeo and Juliet ones would be either third or fourth degree depending on the actual act that occurs.
And the bill proposes, if I'm reading it, an absolute lifetime ban on being licensed as an optometrist if there's a conviction of that nature. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I was not able to determine that myself. I wondered that if a person had a license revoked, first, in order to have a license, you're going to be roughly 28 years old. You've gone through 9 years of college. So if there's an age difference with a licensed practitioner with a young person, it's a big age difference.
But this doesn't specify that the conduct must have occurred in the course and scope of the optometry practice.
That's correct.
And it doesn't say when that incident must have occurred.
That's right.
So if you're 19 years old and you have a 17-year-old girlfriend and you engage in what in fact is felony criminal sexual conduct, even if you later marry that girl and build a family with that girl, and then you finish school and you would find out that you could not be granted an optometry license under this bill. Is that right?
I'm not sure, because as I read this, if a license is revoked, could we then issue another one 5 years later? And I could not determine that myself.
In days. Okay. So the counsel's pointing out to me a rehabilitation provision. Maybe we can take a look at that. Where is that, counsel?
Mr. Chair, members, on page 10, starting in paragraph C on line 14, the person proves by clear and convincing evidence of rehabilitation, which is laid out in the Criminal Offender Rehabilitation Act. So that would be one way they could get a license.
So that could be what? Would you say that again?
Mr. Chairman, it would be on evidence of rehabilitation, which is under the general law governing when government entities and licensees can consider criminal records. And that is, there's a kind of a detailed statute where you can go in and make an argument that you have, you've been rehabilitated. There's a number of different factors that can be considered. You can show, like, a defense document form that I'm not familiar with at all. Or other evidence showing how long it's been since you haven't been convicted, those kinds of factors.
That's why I was arguing.
So you could come in, but you'd have to establish by clear and convincing evidence that you've been rehabilitated, and then you could get the license.
Ms. Pontius, it looks like that rehabilitation provision applies only in subdivision 3 for licenses that have been suspended or revoked, which means at some point the license was granted and then some disqualifying conduct occurred and disciplinary action was taken against the licensee. Is it your reading that that then would not apply to those who have had incidents prior to initially applying for a license, who would be banned from being granted that license under subdivision 2?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. I think it is limited. Just to be either if they've been suspended or revoked. And just under those two paragraphs there, which actually appear above.
Maybe we should take a look at that amendment to Chapter 364 that's found later in this bill. Because we go back to line 9.32, it says that this bill is not subject, the license is not subject to the Rehabilitation Act. And then if we turn to section 13 of the bill, let's see what that amendment is.
Mr. Chair, in section 13,
yes.
In section 13, item F is the addition of the new adding optometry. This you'll notice in D, it says this does not apply to licensed to practice medicine. In E, it says this does not apply to persons denied to practice chiropractic. So, two professions are there, and my guess as time goes is other professions will get listed there too.
So this is saying the rehabilitation process described in Chapter 364 does not apply to those exceptions listed in 364.09, and the proposal is to add paragraph F to that?
Yes, they're adding. Here's are adding paragraph F. Now, again, this was an amendment that we took in the House and Human Services Committee. If I could call your attention, pertinent to this, too, is Section 4 and 10.29, effective dates. The last sentence under 10.32 states a revocation of a license pursuant to subdivision, and we are going to have a technical amendment a little bit later that it should be read number 2, which is a sexual one we're talking about, is not appealable and shall remain in effect indefinitely. Now, as I read that, that says this is a licensed optometrist who is then convicted of some form of sexual offense that this falls under, and they are indefinitely unable to get relicensed. This would not apply to a youth who, after 8 or 9 years of college, applies because they've never had a license. They've never been a licensed professional. So,
Doctor, would you please point out to me where that language is again?
Page 10, line 10.32. It currently says subdivision 3. That's a typo that council brought. Well, actually, I brought to council along with some other ones. It should be read subdivision 2, which brings us back to conviction of felony-level sexual offense.
And that would be a revocation.
Revocation.
Correct?
Yes.
Not a denial of an initial
correct
application for license.
Yes.
But subdivision 2 states that the board may not grant a license,
correct,
which has nothing to do with revocation.
But then it also says
then it goes on to paragraph B as a revocation. Paragraph C denies the rehabilitation chapter. But paragraph A is the inability to grant it in the first place. So that would apply to conduct that occurs at any time in a person's life.
I agree. And I read that and I said, I'm no expert on this problem and rehabilitation of that, but I thought about exactly that same thing, older teenage boy with a younger teenage girl, and I don't know how this goes for other job applications or if this felony stays on your record forever in those young cases, but I personally am not particularly in agreement with that, but that is what the AG brought forward and said this is what medicine is doing. I think it's reasonable to look at the totality of the circumstances in an applicant who has this far back on his record before they were ever a licensed optometrist.
Mr. Backus, our counsel, has pointed out that to me that I think it's the Board of Chiropractic has a modified language relating to this topic. And perhaps we'd like to take a look at that language and see if it addresses it in a way that, of course, I'm just speaking for myself now. I can't speak for the whole committee, but if maybe that language might make me, anyway, more comfortable with it. I mean, these automatic lifetime bans are difficult. We've been dealing in this committee with a lot of second chance legislation that seeks to address the consequences of lifetime consequences of persons' activities. So I, for one, anyway, would like to take a look at some perhaps alternative language that might be more focused on conduct that would specifically be applicable to optometry and the risk to patients and the public from the practice of optometry. Am I the only one kind of blown in the wind here, or Senator Sharon?
I may be the only one blowing in my wind. The others may be with you.
Which way is it?
I wasn't able to find a law book here on this chapter to be able to point to a section in the law about these felonies made prior to an application, which is what you're talking about, early childhood. And there is reference in the law to different sexual offenses. And there's referenced under the law 1A, 1B, things like that, and it references specifically the kind of issue that you're describing that may not rise to the level in adolescence or early adulthood that would prohibit, would cause you to want to prohibit consideration for them for licensure, that you can deal with that specific issue without taking out all of the serious sexual felonies that can occur before a person goes to school. And I'd be very careful as we move towards our desire to offer opportunity for rehabilitation to persons and then reemployment, that we are not creating, especially in professions where they are working with vulnerable populations, that we aren't creating a situation where the public risk is too high.
Senator Sharon, we're on the same page. It's finding the right balance as to which kinds of criminal conduct ought to be prohibitive and which ones aren't.
I think if I could get the law book, the books are gone back here, so I can't reference the chapter to take a look.
I think they're in use by counsel.
Yeah. So maybe it's something that
we'll get you some information, Senator Sharon. Senator Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just agree with you, and I'm wondering, do you think something like this should be tabled for the time and then bring it back with some better language there?
I think that might be a good idea. It's not exactly what Senator Jensen has in mind, but I think that might be a good idea. Maybe I will suggest that we go through the rest of the bill as well and see if we have any other questions. And then if we have any other questions that also need some follow-up, we can do all of that at the same time.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Goodwin.
I'd also like the opportunity to compare what some of the other boards do. This sounds like some of the strictest language I've seen, and it may not be, but I'd like to see how it compares with others. And I was just wondering, in relationship to the testimony we heard last week from Lucy, the young woman, would she have been considered a felony level criminal sexual conductor? You want to say that?
Yes, Senator Goodwin. Mr. Backus, Senate counsel, shaking his head, yes. She would have been subject to a lifetime ban.
And so once again, Mr. Chair, I think we need to proceed with caution, because sometimes we end up doing these things and they have severe unintended consequences for some people. And
Mr.
I just
Chair.
Encourage us to look at this really, really very
Mr. Chair?
Carefully.
Mr. Chair?
Who's saying that?
Me.
Oh.
Senator Jensen.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you. The Minnesota statute is 147.091, which is the medical practice statute.
Yeah.
And this wording is, the board may not grant a license to practice medicine to any person who has been convicted of a felony-level criminal sexual conduct offense. That's where that language came from.
Right. Senator Jensen, the problem is that those aren't before us right now, but
I'm just trying to explain where the language came from.
Well, I understand, so. And it would be natural to adopt language from another comparable statute,
sure.
But this committee has to determine whether we want to perpetuate that language,
sure.
Which may not meet our current-day thinking on how to approach these issues.
Mr. Chair?
Maybe you'd like to propose amending all those other statutes as well. We'll get taken care of all of this in one fell swoop.
Mr. Chair, do you have
suggestions for language. I'm not familiar with how this would work. If we table this, what is the procedure then for us to get some language so that we can get it heard again? Because I would hate to see the work that's been done on the rest of this be held up.
No, I agree, Senator Jensen. And what we would do, what I would propose to do, and Senator Hall actually suggested it, is once we finish going through the bill to see if there are any other questions and stuff that need to be addressed, is we would table the bill, and we would bring the bill back on Friday at our hearing.
Okay.
And in the meantime, counsel and you and others can take a look at, for example, the chiropractic board's language and maybe craft some other language that would address these issues in a way that would still advance your target goal here but without being overbroad.
Thank you.
We'll certainly bring the bill back.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair? Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Doc.
If I might suggest perhaps just striking that first letter A completely and bring it back to, if you're a licensed practitioner and you have engaged in this level of care, basically you can't be trusted to be by yourself with another person in a closed room with no assistant or anybody else present in the future. So if you just delete letter A completely, that takes care of the young person who then chooses to go into a medical profession. It's been a long time since I made application, but I believe applications for schools to get into and for board certification ask questions about convictions of felony convictions. So this is a black mark that follows a person through their life. And if a person, let's say at 17 years old or 18 years old, has this type of conviction and then chooses to spend 9 or 10 or 13 years in a medical profession knowing that there's a lot of places they can't go or maybe no place that they can go, I think it takes care of itself. So if you just struck letter A completely, then it just basically, if you're a licensed professional, you shall be revoked. If you're going to get renewed, we would deny the renewal.
Dr. Cipolla, I appreciate your suggestion here. I'm afraid that might be overbroad in the other direction.
Okay.
There is some responsibility on the part of schools, and I think there's even something now in the higher education law that addresses a mandatory disclosure to applicants for certain courses. They may not be able to practice in the field because of these kinds of prohibitions. I'm not sure I'd want an optometrist who had a conviction for first-degree rape either. Then they wouldn't even get into the position in the first place of being in that room with a person alone and that kind of situation. So I think maybe we need to appreciate the effort, but I think we might want to target a little more finely than just that. So why don't we, if you would go through the other provisions with us, and then we'll complete that review.
Perfect.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. So we'd be now on page 10 at the top, automatic suspension. This is where the court appoints a guardian. The licensee is committed by order of the court, and the license remains suspended until that person is restored to capacity by the court. Upon notice of the board of the judgment, pleaded guilty of felony reasonably related to the practice of optometry, the license shall be automatically suspended until a hearing. Suspension is terminated. The board shall indefinitely suspend or revoke credentials of a regulated person. After hearing, the board finds that it was felonious conduct would cause serious risk of harm to the public in the practice of optometry. Item C, for licenses that have been suspended or revoked, the person may be reinstated to practice either with or without restrictions, rehabilitation. If the person's judgment is overturned by a court, our board shall conduct a hearing and review the suspension within 30 days of receipt. The regulated person would not be required to provide prove rehabilitation if the court were to overrule it. Letter D, the board may act and suspend a regular license without hearing if the regulated person fails to maintain a current name and address with the board as described in E while the regulated person is under board investigation, party to a contested case with the board, party to an agreement for corrective action, or under a board order for disciplinary action, that they, if they disappear from the radar, they will be suspended. And it will be, in effect, lifted pursuant to a petition by the person, so they have a way to come back. Effective dates, all of these items, conditions, limitations shall be in effect determination of appeal of the court. Upon petition for good cause, shall order otherwise, and then that statement that subdivision, as we're going to change to, is not appealable and would remain. Conditions of reissue license, at its discretion, the board may restore and reissue a license to practice optometry, but as a condition may impose disciplinary or corrective actions. Next page, section 6, talks about temporary suspension of the license. In addition to any other remedy, the board may, upon hearing, temporarily suspend a license if the board finds that the optometrist has violated a statute or rule which the board is empowered to enforce, and continued practice by that optometrist would create serious risk of harm to the public.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
May I interrupt to go back? Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We go back to page 10, line 10.32. Under what circumstances is the revocation of a license not appealable?
This is sending you back to subdivision 2. This is a typo. And subdivision 2 is that conviction of a felony-level sexual assault. That's the only thing that, according to this, is remains in effect indefinitely and not appealable.
And, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Doctor, when this bill is talking about non-appealable, are you talking about appealable to the board or appealable within the judicial branch?
This would only be to the board. It would be appealing of a revocation because of a conviction of a felony-level sexual assault while being a practicing licensed optometrist.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think before we lose this thread here, we better move to make that technical change, subdivision 3 on line 10.32, which is apparently a typo. It should be 2. So Senator Newman moves to, on line 10.32, to delete the number 3 and replace it with 2.
So moved.
Hold on a second. Mr. Backus is going to tell us what other changes should be added to Senator Newman's motion.
Mr. Chair, members, there are three other changes on line 11.12 to 11.13. We would delete, 11.13, we would delete paragraph C or D and insert clause 3 or 4. On line 11.18 to 11.19, we would delete paragraph J, L, or Q and insert clause 10, 12, or 17. Then the same change on line 12.1, delete paragraph G, clause 10, 12, or 17.
Senator Newman incorporates that into his amendment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman incorporates those changes into his amendment.
I do, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any questions about Senator Newman's amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Dr. Cipolla, would you please continue then? You were on, I believe, page 11.
Page 11, temporary suspension up at the top.
Yes.
It gives the board the ability to make a temporary suspension if they believe that the conduct would create serious risk of harm to the public. This would be an immediate type of thing as opposed to a long court or hearing process where the person could still be causing trouble. The suspension would take effect upon written notice. It remains in effect until a final order. At the time of the notice, disciplinary hearings will be scheduled. 20 days notice. The hearing should be scheduled to be no more than 90 days after issuance, so it makes it happen promptly. In the evidence section, disciplinary actions alleging a violation of subdivision 1 and those 3 and 4, a copy of the judgment or proceeding under seal of the court, which is entered in the same, shall be admissible into evidence without further authentication and shall constitute evidence of the contents. We're into mental health, access to data, And these changes bring us to the three sections that talk about alcohol, mental health, that the board is able to have consent to submit to a mental and physical examination when directed in writing by the board and have waived all objections. Further, the regulated person would submit to the examination directly constitutes an admission of failure of the person to submit constitutes an admission of the allegation against the person unless the failure is due to circumstances beyond their control. Regulated person shall at all reasonable intervals be given an opportunity to demonstrate that the person can resume competent practice of the regulated profession with reasonable skill and safety to the public. This includes effects of aging, Alzheimer's, dementia kinds of things, which aren't covered anywhere in statute now from the old days. In any proceeding under this paragraph, neither the recordings of the proceeding nor orders shall be entered against the regulated person in any proceeding. B, in addition to ordering a physical and mental exam, the board may or any other law limiting access to medical or health data obtain medical data and health records relating to the regulated person without the applicant or person's consent if the board has probable cause to believe that the regulated person comes under subdivision 1 clause 10, 12, and 17, which is the narcotics, the drugs, and the mental health. The medical data may be requested from the provider, an insurance company, government agency, including the Department of Health and Human Services. A provider, insurance company, or government agency shall comply I think the liability is released unless the data supplied is known to have been false and the person giving the information knew it was false. Now on to reporting obligations.
Yeah, Dr. Spohl, yep. If you could summarize the reporting obligations, our committee's focus will be on subdivision 6, which has to do with subpoenas. So just tell us how those subpoenas would fit into the reporting obligations.
I see subdivision 6. Where is it? Is this still in the
section 9? So I'm talking about page 13, line 9, the subpoena provision under reporting
right
obligations.
So under reporting obligations, institutions are going to be required to report that they have removed a person from practice, restricted their practice, exercised disciplinary proceedings, and this would be under institution. The licensed professional shall report that this has happened to them. This is the self-reporting, and they can do that ahead of time, deadlines. And then the subpoena says that the Board of Optometry may issue subpoenas for the production of those reports for institutions, licensed professionals, and self-reporting.
Okay. I'm going to ask counsel, is this consistent with the subpoena power, consistent with the authority that other comparable boards have?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I haven't looked at all the other boards, but this language looks familiar. I think it's fairly standard in terms of their investigations.
And, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Cipolla.
This does come right from the medical practice statute, word for word.
All right. Thank you. Then Section 10.
Section 10 is immunity. So for those institutions or healthcare facilities, this gives them immunity from providing that information to the board, alleging potential violations. And any report submitted then is considered confidential and absolutely privileged in the hands of the board. Investigation, members of the board, persons employed by, consultants retained by, may help in the preparation of charges, management of board orders on behalf of the board, and they are also immune from civil liability and prosecution. And members of the board themselves engaged in maintaining records and making reports regarding adverse health events are immune from civil liability transactions. And for the purpose of this section, a member of the board, a consultant described, is considered a state employee. So I think this is just protecting those who have to look into these problems and make decisions from lawsuits and claims.
And members, and as noted in our staff report, making them a state employee means they're covered by the State Tort Claims Act and the caps on damages that would apply there as well. That would be the significance of making them. So if any of the immunities were somehow overcome by certain showings in a court of law, they'd still be they'd be covered by the Tort Claims Act's limits. All right, and then Dr. Cipolla, well, we've already addressed Section 13, which was a looks like it was a conforming amendment cross-referencing the earlier change to the Rehabilitation Act. Right, Counsel?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is really the operative language that totally exempts them from the Rehabilitation Act, with the minor exception that we discussed earlier where somebody can piggyback in on that rehabilitation language. But otherwise, they're exempt from Chapter 364.
And, Counsel, does that Rehabilitation Act help? To whom does it apply?
Mr. Chairman,
just medical members, professionals?
It's basically pretty much all state employment and licensing. So it's fairly broad.
I think we may...
state and local government. So basically it's all government, employment, and licensing. You have sort of a general rule that you can't disqualify someone from public employment or licensure based on a conviction unless it directly relates to the position or license. And then,
there's a list of exceptions.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. And that list of exceptions appears in the bill. And this would add this board to those that are exempt.
Which would be to say that you could not take advantage of the rehabilitation provisions in Chapter 364 if you're listed among the exceptions?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct, except, again, for that little piece where you can show evidence of rehabilitation just for in a couple narrow circumstances in the bill.
Because that is separately described elsewhere in this bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's actually cross-referenced in the bill. But that's the only piece of Chapter 364 that's picked up.
Okay. Well, I think given some of the context of our conversations this year in this committee, we may want to take a fresh look at this exception provision in the Rehabilitation Act to see if it still meets with modern standards of thinking on this topic. But we may wish to flag at least the provision that is proposed in this bill for further consideration when we take the bill back up on Friday. Are there any questions from members of the committee on this bill at this time? And I will ask if there's anyone else in the audience who wants to be heard on this as well. Senator Goodwin?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions, if it's okay. I wanted to find out if the optometrists, if their association, their personal associations, know this bill and what their reaction is to this bill.
Senator
Cipolla.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they've been sitting at the table with the development of this. Right along participating in this, and their executive director from the Minnesota Optometric Association is in attendance here today. They have no objections and are in support of it as we have brought this forward.
Okay, and then another question. I have some concerns about the ability to bypass some of the Data Practices Act and be able to go in and get information on somebody's medical and physical records with just on the basis of just a complaint from somebody else about a person. This seems very wide open for potential views, and I don't know if any other boards have that kind of ability to just without the person's consent go in and get their medical records and their that's pretty well spelled out by HIPAA laws that it's not really I mean, I think law enforcement can probably do that, but I'm not sure that a board should have the ability to investigate people's personal records. Some of the language, and you can answer that in relation to this too, some of the language in here talks about mental health and mental illness, and I have some concerns about that because one out of five people have some form of mental illness in their lifetime, and so I'm thinking this could be a depression or whatever, and if somebody's saying that the person's then medical records, because they're acting depressed, have to be allowed for overview by the board, that's a significant violation of privacy rights, I think. So, I mean, I can see when you're saying somebody is mentally incompetent to practice, it's different than having a mental illness, but you have both covered in here. I don't know how long was spent on this, and I know this is an important issue. And by the way, my first half of my life, I was a dispensing optician, so I've been in the practice. But I do think that it is important to make sure that we're not being overbearing here. We're not depriving optometrists of rights that maybe other medical professionals have, as far as their privacy rights and so forth. Just my comment. That's all I have to say, and you can respond any way you like. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Cipolla.
Senator, thank you. Good questions. I'm unable to flip through the pages and find it, but it absolutely is in here that we must have the consent of a patient to access their medical record, and if we do not have that consent, then the doctor providing the record is required to delete any reference or any indications to the name or any identification data. That is current practice, as I understand. I'm not on the complaint committee of our board, but I have heard that that's exactly the case. If a patient complains and they are not willing to attach their name to it, then it has to be redacted. And that was in here. And I had a good answer for that. Now, on the second question.
I'm sorry. Let me just go back to that, because I see here, and maybe you can explain why then. Maybe there's contradictory language in here. But on page 11, lines 11.33 to 11.36, it says that in addition to ordering a physical or medical exam, the board may, notwithstanding these statutes, or any other law limiting access to medical or other health data, obtain medical data and health records relating to a regulated person or applicant without the person's or applicant's consent, if with probable cause. So I don't know if you have other language that conflicts with that, but that language tells me that you would be allowed to get into people's private records.
Yes, and perhaps, Mr. Chair,
Dr. Cipolla,
I misunderstood. For a general member of the public, their private data is not accessible unless they sign off.
Correct.
That it can be. For the practicing doctor who is licensed, they do not have to sign off. That's, I guess, the purpose here is that if there is an issue that caused a violation of items 1 through 22 that we talked about earlier, and it states here that the board has probable cause that regulated or licensed person has violated something in those items of number 10, number 12, and number 17, that they must provide this data. And failure to, I believe it says here, because we just read it a bit ago, failure to provide that data then admits that there's a problem. Mm. So,
No.
Wow. So, Dr. Cipolla, these are applying only, as you said, to items 10, which is adjudication as mentally incompetent, ill, or developmentally disabled.
Yep.
12, inability to practice optometry with reasonable skill and safety to patients. And that does cover deterioration of skills through the aging process, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And 17, which covers addiction to drugs or intoxicants.
Correct. Right.
Just under those three circumstances.
Just those three.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I share your caution about this. And I know that this bill is trying to create that balance between individuals' privacy and the safety of the public, but I still share your caution. I get nervous when I see bills that limit or make a liability-free zone for anyone under law. What would happen if the board misused the information they have? What would be the balance that we like to put into law in order to prevent such misuse by a board if they happen to have an immunity from liability regarding the information that they are that we would bestow on them through this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limerick.
Dr. Cipolla.
I think the last sentence says information obtained.
What line are you on?
12.9 and 12.10. Information obtained under this subdivision is classified as private data under sections 1301 and 1387. I presume that refers elsewhere to state statutes regarding privacy of data. So if there were misuse, willful misuse, that does not, you don't have immunity from that. Somebody left a briefcase. It's just like the HIPAA. If you have patient records and you leave a briefcase in an unattended area and somebody takes it, you are in violation because you didn't protect that data and there was a reasonable chance that it could have been taken. If there were a break-in at the board office and criminal activity took place and private data was stolen, that's different. But this clearly states that any data that would be received is confidential, protected by the data practices, protected by HIPAA, and the board and its employees are required to exercise all reasonable skills to provide that protection for all data that we might have.
Dr. Cipolla, I think Senator Limmer has hit on a good point because it looks like under Section 10, notwithstanding the classification of the data as private under Chapter 13, Section 10 provides immunity to members of the board and employees of the board for any, basically any actions that are done relating to their duties to investigate. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like they would not be subject to the sanction provisions in Chapter 13 for violations or any other violations. I know that Mr. Carlson wanted to comment on the immunity question, so while we are addressing that, we'll invite Joe Carlson to the table.
This is just as it gets to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Association for Justice, and we do watch all things immune. don't oppose the bill necessarily, but do believe that Senator Goodwin and Senator Limmer and you, Mr. Chair, have pointed out it's a pretty gaping absolute immunity and how we have captured these. And I haven't had a chance to talk to Senator Jensen. I didn't know this particular immunity was quite so broad, but I know you asked her to think about updating all the other boards of practice, and what we've been doing in this area in a piecemeal basis is inserting the words good faith. And there's no good faith exception in the Section 10, and that's what I would not even ask you to change it, but ask you to, you know, to look at. And that is, you know, for mandatory reporters under 626, for all health licensing boards under 214, for the Board of Psychology under 148, there's a good faith requirement. So if I am misusing that data, which means I'm not using it at a proper time, at a proper place, with a proper motive, I have breached my obligation of good faith, and then I do not pick up this blanket absolute immunity. And so, you know, I think both in subdivisions 1, 2, and 2, subdivision A and B, that you could, you know, consider putting that good faith obligation. So it's not just an absolute immunity, so that if I do, I can envision an abuse that I could argue is rising out of my duties in my job, whether it's an employee accessing records that they shouldn't, that was my job, or maybe it wasn't. So I would ask you to at least consider that. And that was our concern about the language, Mr. Chairman. Happy to work on making that proper. But as these have come through, we've tried to get that, requirement of acting in good faith. And it's, listed in dozens of places in statute. And I think it may appropriately belong here. Happy to answer any questions.
I think what I'm going to ask Mr. Carlson to do is before Friday, as we're taking a relook at some of the language here, if you'd submit suggestions to Ms. Pontius or counsel and to Senator Jensen for review, and we'll take up that question on Friday as well.
And to be fair, the witnesses are absolutely correct. The immunity in Section 10 exactly mirrors the Board of Medicine. But as other boards, like Board of Psychology, have come on, they've changed and updated the language to this good faith requirement. And so I'm happy to do that.
I'm sure counsel is making note of some of the items we'll need to update more broadly in other statutory provisions for other boards. But again, we won't delay Senator Jensen's vote to accomplish that.
And just to be clear for Senator Jensen and others, we don't oppose what they're trying to do here, but just think it can be some better protections.
Thank you. Any other members in the room wish to be heard on this bill? Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, if I could bring our committee's attention to page 11, line 18. There's a reference to the term probable cause. I'm not sure if probable cause, since it's a criminal law reference for use of art, is the appropriate one. I'm not sure if this is... I know it's examining these other clauses earlier in the paragraph. When I think of probable cause, I think of whether or not a crime has been committed and whether an individual person has actually committed it. And I'm wondering if maybe reason to believe might be a more appropriate term. I don't know, but I'm just wondering if it's the correct use of the term in this statute.
Mr. Backus or Ms. Pontius, care to comment on
Mr. Chair, members, I was just looking through, one random board with a chiropractic board, I believe it is, and they have the same language, probable cause. So I guess it is used at least some civil context. I'm not familiar with it, though, generally. And it's another thing we could kind of look into if you'd like.
The reason I brought it up, Mr. Chair, is that in another committee, the elections committee, we were examining the use of probable cause in reference to a violation of a public disclosure board reference in law, the appropriate behavior. They changed probable cause to reflect more of the civil law reference to reason to believe. I don't know if that's appropriate for this or not, but we can have counsel examine it.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Jensen or the testifier, taking off from the same line where Senator Limmer just launched from, where you have 11.17 and in line 11.18, if it's believed that a person or regulated person comes under Subdivision 1, and the board directs the person to submit to a mental or physical examination, can you tell me who bears the cost of that?
I believe, without being able to put my finger on it, that the person who is the regulated person bears the cost to substantiate their skills or whatever. I do not believe that this is a board. And I want to be sure we understand that it isn't all items under Subdivision 1. It's just 10, 12, and 17, which are mentally incompetent, mentally ill, inability to practice with reasonable skill due to alcohol, drugs, narcotics, or becoming addicted or habituated. The probable cause aspect would be a complaint that is substantiatable as opposed to a random unsigned or undocumented type of thing. So if a complaint comes in that the optometrist was intoxicated, slurring his words, failed to use dilating drops as part of a routine adult eye examination, or would forget the person's name four or five times in an interview, such as perhaps in the case of dementia or some other mental illness, that if a complaint came in, this would be the probable cause. It is not a situation where board members would be at a convention or meeting and say, that guy's not, he's not doing very good, because that wouldn't be a probable cause. That would be one person writing a complaint perhaps to the state, to the board, because his competitor, and it's a competitor, something like that. So these probable causes are from written complaints that would be detailed enough to indicate it's number 10, number 12, or number 17.
Mr. Chair, may I have a follow-up
Senator
question?
Champion.
And so are you saying that if a person sends in a note or complaint saying, I believe Bobby Champion, for an example, didn't do a certain procedure correctly, that would be enough? And if it, falls under these other categories, that simply that person making that allegation could rise and does rise to the level of probable cause as you all are defining it with your group in order to perhaps suggest or have someone suggest to me as the regulated person that I need a mental or physical examination? I just want to be clear about that because that's what I think I heard you say, but I want to be clear that I'm hearing it.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Sproul.
And we can clarify that a little bit more. For example, number 12, where you said didn't do a procedure the proper way, this is by reason of illness, use of alcohol, drugs, narcotics, chemicals, or other type of material, or as a result of any mental or physical condition, including deterioration through the aging process of loss of motor controls. So it has to be something related to the inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety due to these reasons, not necessarily due to, shall we say, incompetence or any other reason that would not trigger illness, alcohol, drugs, narcotics, chemicals, or whatever.
Senator Goodman, last question, and then we're going to lay the bill on the table.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to take up another question if somebody else has one. So somebody else that hasn't asked any yet.
I think we've all gotten
okay.
The oil in the water here.
I'm just concerned because I just talked to the nurses today, and they tell me that if they voluntarily go into a treatment program for alcohol or drug abuse or whatever, and they complete the program, they don't lose their license to practice. Well, I see that on page 13 you have the self-reporting that the optometrist shall report to the board any personal action. And what is your process? Let me just ask you quickly. What is your process for dealing with people that have addictions that are trying to take care of them?
Perfect. Thank you.
Dr. Sepulveda.
Professional health program, is that PHP?
HPSP.
Is what it stands
HPSP.
For?
HPSP.
PHP, professional health program, is what all health-related licensed professions from ambulance drivers to physicians and nurses, dentists, we would refer this case to them. They would do their determination as to whether there is an addiction or a problem. And as long as they don't send us a letter back saying this person didn't show up, they did not complete anything after 5 years of monitoring by this group, this person is then cleared and there's nothing on their record at all.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to lay this bill on the table now. It will come back before the committee on Friday, and hopefully we'll be able to get the bill into shape that day. Any last comments, Senator Jensen?
Sure, Mr. Chair, I just want to comment. I appreciate the efforts of the members of the committee. This was an attempt to update outdated disciplinary and complaint processes back from 1925. So you can tell just from a session of changes that are happening within boards and licensee how changes from 1925 would look to this particular piece of legislation. So we wanted to update outdated procedures. We don't want to use outdated procedures to do that. So I appreciate the chair and the committee making sure that we're using current and modern language and get it in here so that it's not that long before we get some more changes in here. So I look forward to working with the chair and the committee to make sure when we come back on Friday we have language that meets your concerns.
Okay, Senator Jensen, we're with your help, we're creating the model for other revisions, and perhaps this will last for another 100 years.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Jensen, thank you. We're going to lay Senate File 1904 on the table. And shall I say, Senator Jensen, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
All right, thank you both. We're going to – the collateral consequences bill, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get to today. That Senate file, 1676, we're going to put that on Thursday's noon agenda. It'll be second on the agenda, so we'll definitely get that done. It does have two more stops before going to finance, but I've been assured that we're going to be able to move those through the rest of the committee process if we delay that until Thursday. Senator Hoffman, we're not up yet because we have to go back to Senator Dahl's bill. Senator Dahl got called to another committee, I understand we have to get both Senator Dahl's and Senator Hoffman's bills out today so that deadlines can be I've been told the deadlines can be met, but one's going to finance, one's going to the floor. So we'll see how quickly these go. I should say, Senator Dahl, come forward if you wish complete your bill. Thank you for returning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your flexibility and I think we were at questions. I think our testifiers were finished. So if your committee has any questions, I think that's where we're leaving it.
Well, we left off. Senator Limmer was about to ask a second question, and we set the bill aside. So, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a brief wrap-up, Senator Dahl, we talked about the need for or the decision of whether or not we should define the term collision because it's used predominantly in your bill. The answer of one of your testifiers claimed that that probably was not necessary. I spoke about a freeway that's very congested and whether or not one would be obligated to pull over immediately in a highly congested, high-speed area where even law enforcement has difficulty enforcing traffic law, and was told that at the earliest safe location, you should pull over and inform law enforcement of what had happened. My other question that I wanted to get to, and this goes back to the term collision, if rather suddenly you were faced driving down a freeway and let's say a roll of something, whether it's a carpet roll or an undefined clump of debris would be in that road and you couldn't avoid it due to the congestion or the speed you were going, you hit it instead of hitting it like a collision would be a direct impact, but you rolled over it. Are you under that same obligation to call based on what you thought might be just debris? But if it was something that you didn't really know what was in a content of a box or what might appear to be a roll of carpet or something, does that necessitate that same treatment of calling?
Ms. Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. No, it would not, because although there's this broad duty to stop for a collision, a person is only going to be criminally liable if they've in fact collided with a person or another car. So if you're driving along and you're paying attention and you see something fall out and you can't avoid it and you hit it and you don't stop, that's just fine, and you wouldn't need to call law enforcement in that situation. You might want to have them remove something from the road, but you wouldn't be criminally liable for not calling in that situation.
But Ms. Mueller, what happens if it's dark out and you're not sure? It looks like it's a box that fell off a construction truck, but it turns out it's not. And in all of your reasonable judgment with your headlights and street lamps and everything else, it sure looked like it was just a construction object. Turns out it wasn't. You're in trouble then, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I think I was thinking of a scenario where he's posing where something is falling off the back of a truck. So as opposed to like a construction barrel, if you're driving along and it's dark and you collide with something and you don't know what it is, then you need to stop and figure out what that is.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
That goes back to my question. Does running over something in the freeway mean collide, as you just referenced? You don't know what it is. You thump over something, and are you obligated to make a call? When on page 17 through 18, when the collision involves a person or another vehicle, mistake as to what was struck is not a defense for failure to stop. But this is not a, we don't think it may be a person. It certainly is not another vehicle. I'm just trying to get a little tighter description of what the driver would be obligated to do in an unidentified something in the road that they run into. And it's not that it fell off a truck. It's just there. We don't know where it came from. I travel the freeways a lot in the Twin Cities area, and due to the nature of my real estate work, and it's just amazing what's in the lanes that you sometimes come up on.
Ms. Mueller.
Right, Mr. Chair and Senator. So if, and I'm sorry I misunderstood before, because I was thinking you were actually physically seeing something falling off a truck. If you're hitting something in the road, I mean, I know I've driven over boxes. You know, there are things that you do drive over on the road, but you know what those things are. But if you don't know what it is and you collide with something, you need to stop and figure out what it is. It could be a person in a crosswalk, for example. So then it is your responsibility to stop and investigate, figure out what it is.
So, Ms. Mueller, what if I hit a big ice chunk in the middle of the road, and it sounds really bad, and I'm in the middle of the highway? I mean, do I have to stop to see if it was an ice chunk?
No, you don't, Mr. Chair, because you know it's an ice chunk, and
what if I don't know what it is? I presume it's an ice chunk because there are ice chunks falling off of trucks and cars all the time on the highway this time of year. But I don't know for sure. I just hear the clump as I go over it down the middle lane on 94. What's my duty then?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, if you're driving and paying attention to the road, then you would know it was an ice chunk and not a person. And that's what we're trying to avoid here is the person that says, well, I hit something and I just didn't know what it was, and it turns out that it was a person or a car. So we want people to stop and investigate what it is, but they're not going to be criminally liable for not stopping if it is an ice chunk or a box or a carpet roll. But if they're not paying attention and they don't know what it is they hit, then they do need to stop and figure out and make sure it wasn't a person.
Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon.
What I think I understand you to say is that what you're trying to accomplish with this bill is in the instance is to close the gap where someone uses the I thought it was something else or I didn't know what it was as an excuse in court when they have hit a person and created harm. And it isn't about wanting everybody to stop every time they collide with something if they know what it is. And if they don't know what it is, but they're pretty sure it was an ice chunk on the highway, they can continue to go. But if it was a person and they are charged with hit and run, they can no longer say, well, gee, I thought it was an iceberg or something. They have to say, they have to be able to say, well, I stopped and I was sure it was an iceberg. But if you want to take the risk yourself and go on, I suppose, and say that was the high probability was an ice chunk, you can do that. It's just that if it wasn't, you can no longer say, gee, I thought it was an ice chip. It's no longer a defense. That's what I think you're trying to accomplish with this. You're not trying to prosecute people who don't stop and look at their ice chunks or stop and look at the rubber from a truck tire or something. It's that you can no longer use the fact that you didn't stop and look as a defense in a hit-and-run accident.
I'm just a bit concerned we're going to have a lot of people stopping on the highway out of fear that maybe they didn't quite see exactly what it was that they hit and creating some more hazards because they're stopping and pulling over to investigate. I'm trying to think of scenarios here that we don't want to create more harm with what may be a reasonable attempt to close a loophole in the law. Ms. Mueller?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator. You did summarize the purpose of this bill exactly. And I think that we did talk to Department of Transportation. We didn't get an official we didn't talk to ask for their stamp of approval, but we did talk to the Chief of Engineering for the Department of Transportation, and they didn't see a problem with this bill. We wanted to make sure we don't want that. We don't want people stopping every time they hit a squirrel or an ice chunk. Again, you are presumed to know what when you're driving, you're presumed to be paying attention. It's those people who don't know what it is they've hit, and you know it turns out to be a person or another car. We want to make sure that those people can't then later say, well, I just thought it was a mailbox or I thought it was an ice chunk. So I don't think we're going to get that many more people stopping every time they hit a squirrel to get out and make sure the squirrel wasn't a two-year-old.
Well, Ms. Mueller, with all due respect, I don't give much credence to the opinion of an engineer as to what the legal liability might be for failure to stop or obligations to stop. I'm a little worried about potholes out there, too. I mean, maybe I don't see a pothole. I mean, I'm not trying to be flip. I mean, these are the scenarios that are going to come up in court somewhere along the line. And someone's going to be making the defense that, you know, they were absolutely certain what they hit was an ice chunk or was a pothole. And if it turns out not to have been the case, then they've got absolute liability. I mean, there's no defense that they can interpose, even though they may say absolutely they were not culpable in any way, shape, or form based on what they knew, they saw, at least they thought for with certainty that they saw something. And it would not have been any risk whatsoever for them to go on. So I'm trying to see how this is going to play out in a real case.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't that, what you have just described, really come down to being a jury question and not an absolute defense? Would not a jury have to decide whether or not your description of I thought I hit an ice chunk is reasonable and accurate or not?
Senator Newman, line 7.17 says, when a collision involves a person or another vehicle, mistake as to what was struck is not a defense. So the jury will be instructed that's not a defense that can be used, and in fact the defendant might be prohibited from testifying that was the defense, because it would simply be inadmissible as evidence as a matter of law. Senator Dahl.
I think you mentioned a person or another vehicle. So, again, think about how broad the definition is now, or the kind of things that people are using as a defense now. We believe narrowing it and being a little bit more specific. But I think, hopefully, and again, a jury may have to enter into this. Did the person really hit a pothole, or person or another vehicle is really what's specific to this.
But he restricted from
and again, as I finish my comment here, I think let's get back to the victim that may be laying there that we didn't stop for. That's really what this is about. And as our testifier here said, she knew exactly what defense Amy Sensor was going to use when she heard about that accident. She knew exactly as you were driving down the highway, listening to it on the radio. And sure enough, there will be more. There will be more.
I did have a question about the definition of collision, just to suggest that I don't think that's just going to be a jury question. Every defense attorney is going to ask for a jury instruction for a definition of collision. And the judge is either going to grant the request or he's going to deny the request, and they're going to come up with some definition perhaps. The defense counsel is going to propose a definition. They'll be creating an issue for appeal as to whether or not collision is a question of fact for the jury or ought to have been given instructions. So just for the record, we can't sit here and decide what's going to end up being a jury question and what's going to be a legal question a judge is going to get involved in. So I don't want this record to reflect that we're trying to make those decisions either on behalf of the court, nor should we make our decisions based on a presumption in that regard. And that doesn't necessarily go to the merits of the bill, just so that we kind of recognize. We can only go so far as a legislative committee here.
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
Listening to this discussion, and I'm sort of stepping away from the specifics enough to say that if you're trying to defend somebody that's as a result of the vehicular damages hurt somebody seriously or killed somebody, you would want the law to stay the way it is right now. You'd absolutely want to have every opportunity to get that person free of their responsibility. And I don't think that's a good idea. So, while we talk about that, we also have to talk about the other side of the equation, and that is that the prosecution is being confronted with a situation in which there is a defense that's allowed that's very difficult to judge what was in the mind of a person in terms of what they saw or didn't know when there are people who are being harmed by vehicles. So right now, it appears, at least to me, that it's out of balance, and to not do something about, you know, along the lines of this leaves way too much of a gaping hole for persons who are defending clients who have done harm under the influence of alcohol or simply distracted driving on a phone or various kinds of things, because they're just going to say, gee, I thought it was and maybe they did. That's the other thing. You know, maybe you thought it was just a little ice chunk. And maybe it doesn't take much of a little knock to hurt somebody with your car. But all this bill is saying is when that happens, and if there's any question in your mind, you should stop and take a look to see what you did. Because then you're not criminally negligent, unless you've been under the influence of alcohol and you want to get the heck out of there. Or you're going to demonstrate something that shows that you have vehicular liability. So I think that there's merit to what's being presented here.
Senator Sharon, the prosecution has a difficult burden of proving what's in some defendant's mind in half of the crimes that are listed in our state statute books, especially where specific intent is an element of the crime. And it's admittedly a difficult burden, but it's done all over the place. And I don't think anyone disagrees that people ought to stop and see if what they hit was a person and needs to be attended to. I think the question is, can we do that in such a way that that finally targets that conduct and doesn't have unintended, overbroad consequences? And the question, I think, really is this language here tuned finely enough to accomplish that end without creating a different set of complications? Senator Champion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, I can appreciate the challenge that we have before us, which is to look at this public policy in comparison to what is the current law and see if there is the possibility to make some modifications that will continue to push us forward. If that is our charge and if that's our quest, which I believe it is, I think this particular bill takes us out of balance. And what I mean by that is, to the degree a person has the ability to articulate before the court what they thought or what they believed at the time, and for the trier of fact to be able to have that information and make a determination, is really what we want at the end of the day. That's why we have a trier of fact. That's why we have, you know, someone else who is supposed to be impartial and make an informed decision based on all the evidence that has been put before them. And as we think about that, the example that has been put forward to us has been the Amy Sensor case. And in fact, in that particular case, and although I definitely agree with the chair, we should all stop once we see or believe that something has occurred, that we should all stop. But given that the Sensor case is our example that has been presented before us, in that case, that particular person was convicted. And that there was a trier of fact who got together and said, based on all the information, based on the law, here's what we had. Here's what we believe. But Amy Sensor, as a defendant constitutionally, I think we should also balance that has a right to put forth what occurred from that particular day, even though the state has the burden. I'm talking about from a defense perspective. And getting specifically to the notion of how one's defense is now challenged is, I go back to line 7.17 and 7.18 when it says, when the collision involves a person or another vehicle, mistake as to what was struck is not a defense. Means you can't even bring it up. You can't put it before the jury. It's not something that you could ask the trier of fact to wrestle with. You are now precluded from being able to put that forward as a defense. And I think that's where the imbalance lies. because a person should have an opportunity to say, I thought I hit a pothole. Here's why I thought I hit a pothole. There are lots of potholes coming down whatever street it is and was. And the trier of fact should have the ability and the wherewithal by which to listen to that information, weigh that information, and come back with a verdict.
Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl. Ms. Mueller.
Yep, please. Mr. Chair and Senator. So the state still has to prove that the driver knew there was a collision. And that's where the defense attorney could argue, if their client really thought it was a pothole, that the driver didn't know there was a collision that required them to stop. The state still has to prove some type of knowledge. It's just this not the specific knowledge that they hit a person or a car. And I will say that while Amy Sensor was convicted, that was a very long and drawn-out trial because of the problems in this case. And that Al-Nazir case was discussed at length in that trial. As a reminder, Kane Thompson was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver, and his conviction was reversed by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court actually suggested the language that we're arguing for here today. In addition, there was a Dakota County case where a victim was struck by a driver, and the driver fled. And they could show that the driver had purchased methamphetamine that morning, but, of course, by the time they found him, it wasn't in his system. And it ended up in a hung jury because the jury couldn't answer the question of whether or not he knew he hit a person in a crosswalk. So it has occurred in other cases as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
So to the testifier, I totally understand what it is that you have articulated, but what I think you appear to miss, unless you can correct me, is that when we look at the definition of collision, there's no definition of collision even in the bill as we have it right now, which in my mind creates more of a problem because now different judges can apply a different definition to the notion of collision. That then will be appealable by a number of different people. There will be fights all over the state all around the notion of collision. And then that's one aspect of the element, right? So one element is collision or whether there was a collision. But then the second element that a person should be able to argue, you are now removing, which is for them to say, even though there may have been a collision, I thought I hit a pothole. But with this bill, now you want that person to be precluded from being able to reasonably articulate or put forward a defense as to the second element of the notion that you are putting forward. And that's where I believe the imbalance lies. One, there's no real clear definition for collision. And number two, you're now precluding and limiting a person's ability to put forward a defense as it pertains to what they believe that they ran into. And so I just think that, you know, that causes a problem.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Probably no more than current law because there in statute there is no definition of collision, crash, or accident. Again, we think that the defense right now is using this excuse too much right now. The things that you've raised are probably going to remain there whether this law passes or not, but we believe that we can save some lives if people aren't laying along the side of the road at night and people continuously use the argument that, oh, I thought I hit a barrier. I thought I hit a cone. And I know, as a driver's ed teacher for 30 years, and I've sat in the driver's ed car 10 hours a day every summer, I know when my student hits a pothole, an ice chunk, another car, a mailbox, and we haven't hit a pedestrian, thank God, yet, but I know what we hit with my particular students. I believe that this actually helps, as the Supreme Court has directed us, not hinders, some real justice to the victims that are out there.
Mr. Chair, just one comment.
Senator Champion.
Senator, I would hope that you would frame it just a little differently from my perspective. As opposed to using the word an excuse, that would suggest that any person who has a reason to believe differently about a person, if they put forth a rationale, then is deemed an excuse. And I think that undermines the balanced notion that I'm speaking to. Not an excuse, but whether they have a different idea or a different version as to the facts, as to what happened and what they believed at the time. That is their rendition or their perspective, but not an excuse. And so I would hope that we would consider it differently when we think in terms of balance and the constitutionality of one's ability to make sure that they exercise their right to a trial, exercise their right to be heard, and that's not an excuse. That is their constitutional right.
Senator
and
Letts.
So I would hope that we would keep that in balance.
Senator Letts.
Senator Sherman.
I would like, Ms. Mulder, would you repeat again what you said and try to stretch it out a little for me, that you were saying that the defendant still had an opportunity to a defense you were talking about, which is responding to Senator Champion's concern that there isn't a right to a defense. But there was something that you mentioned very briefly, and I want you to extrapolate more clearly what it was you were talking about that is in response to that concern that the defense would have.
Ms. Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. Yes, I was saying that the state still has to prove that the driver knew that there was a collision. We're not taking all knowledge out of the statute. We're not creating what's called a strict liability offense in this case. The state still has to prove that the driver knew there was a collision. They just no longer have to prove that the driver knew it was a collision with a person or a car. So once if the state can prove that the driver knew there was a collision, then the question is, did the person stop and investigate and stay at the scene?
And Senator Letts,
and
because there's not a definition anywhere of collision, it's simply what we assume it to be, that they hit something?
That's correct. It would be
some
sort of impact that would cause them, that would necessitate the duty to stop. And I think, you know, we've gone around with other hypotheticals discussing this as well. And, you know, a pothole wouldn't necessarily be a collision that would require somebody to stop. And that would be a jury question or perhaps a defense the defendant would use. But again, the state still has to prove that the driver knew that they had a collision.
Ms. Mulder, with all due respect, your definition of collision as that you hit something such that you knew you would have to stop is a legally circular argument.
Absolutely.
You have to stop because you hit something, and the definition of hitting something is you know you have to stop for it. So a record would have to be a little more clear guidance to the court. And that's part of the problem I think we're running into. And believe me, I know every member of this committee well enough to know we all have sympathy for the situation that Ms. Zell and her family had to go through. And none of us wants to see anyone left on the side of the road that's been struck. But the challenge, the duty of this committee is to try to fashion a statute, a law that's going to apply throughout the state in a manner that's going to accomplish the desired end and balance the appropriate rights and responsibilities of all that are involved here. And so we're trying our best to do that here. And it's not an easy question. I know the other committee that's appeared before as well struggled to some degree with that, but it didn't really fall within their jurisdiction to struggle as much with some of these specific questions as we're wrestling with. Senator Dole.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and that's exactly why we're here, because of the Supreme Court suggesting that we could maybe actually give some more direction to the language. So I do hope that you support the bill, but it is supported by the County Attorneys Association, the Sheriff's Association, Minnesota for Safe Driving, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, and there's a nice editorial in the Star Tribune on Monday supporting this particular bill. So I do hope that you can find it in yourself to this direction.
I'm going to give the chief author the last word. Is there a motion?
Oh, I'll make the motion.
Senator Goodwin, what's your motion?
To move this bill, to vote on this bill. All right. Let me see the file number. Just
1246.
1246. That Senate file 1246 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor, I believe.
As amended.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate file 1246 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. I ask for a show of hands. All those in favor, raise your hand. Four. All those opposed, raise your hand.
C4. By a vote of 4-4, the motion does not prevail. We have reached the end of our scheduled time for hearing today. So, Senator Hoffman, we're not going to be able to take this up, if you're still in the room. I'm sorry. We're not going to be able to take this up today.
So looking forward to hanging out with you guys.
I know you are.
So
we're going to ask you to return, please, on Friday. We'll put you first on the agenda on Friday. You'll still make first deadline because your next stop is the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Members, a few scheduling announcements. We're going to meet Thursday at noon and again at 6 p.m.
Noon instead of 10 o'clock, Mr. Chair? Oh, that's
on
10
Thursday.
O'clock on Friday. Okay.
Friday, we will meet at 10 a.m. and we will go until the agenda is completed. I can't guarantee when that will be. We have 14 bills on the agenda right now, and with re-referrals, there may be some more added. We did attempt to get this room for the next two Fridays at 10 a.m., but it's already booked. So the best we can do is to start at noon on the following two Fridays, and again, we'll be going until those agendas are completed. As I said before, we're going to do our very best to take up all the re-referrals that we can, schedule permitting. It's an accelerated time frame this year. So, members, thank you for doing sometimes difficult work of this committee. Appreciate your work today. We are adjourned.